Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Today is April 2nd, and the first order, and the quorum is present, even though we are missing some members today. And of course, I will say, as I said yesterday, that members are going in and out with other places they need to be, so that's kind of normal for this part of the year. So, first order of business is to move the minutes. Representative Feist.
Yes, Madam Chair, I've reviewed the minutes and they look good, and so I will move the minutes.
All right, thank you. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes of April 1st, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So we again have a really full agenda. As everyone knows, this is an extra meeting. So we're just trying to get through as much work as we can with our very short timelines. And so appreciate everyone's cooperation. So the first bill on our agenda is House File 2354, the second engrossment, Representative Norris. Let's see, Representative Norris, welcome. And let's see, we've got the motion will be, I will move that House File 2354, the second engrossment, be re-referred to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. I don't think we have an amendment in the packet, so I think we can proceed. And Representative Norris, please go ahead and present your bill.
Great. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. It's great to be with you to present House File 2354. Minnesotans are a generous people. When our neighbors and our communities are struggling, we believe in offering them a helping hand. It's disappointing, frustrating, and completely unacceptable when that generosity is taken advantage of. Medical assistance fraud steals from hardworking taxpayers across Minnesota. It also steals money meant to provide health care to low-income Minnesotans. That's disgraceful, and we're here to help crack down on this kind of fraud. Attorney General Ellison's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit already does great work catching people who steal from medical assistance and making sure that they are held accountable. For instance, an audit recently found that they've won the most convictions for provider fraud when compared to similarly sized states across the country. And this unit, with an annual budget of about $5 million, has won over $53 million in civil penalties and restitution in the last 5 years alone. We're in judiciary today since this bill does a couple of things. First, it expands the office's subpoena power when it comes to investigating Medicaid fraud. At present, even when the Attorney General's office is conducting a criminal investigation, it lacks the authority to acquire certain financial records. This is an authority that county attorneys already have when prosecuting similar cases. And so it only makes sense that Attorney General Ellison's office should have these subpoena powers as well. The bill also makes conforming changes to give the Attorney General's office authority to prosecute the beefed up medical assistance fraud crime that's included in the bill, and it establishes venue rules for that medical assistance fraud crime as well. We've seen a lot of attention on fraud related to grant programs in the Minnesota House, and while scrutinizing grants is important, I also think it's important to underscore that for the Department of Human Services, which is our largest state agency, only 3% of the funds that go out the door are in the form of grants. In contrast, 89% of the funds that go out the door are in the form of Medicaid. So this bill is aimed at addressing one of the largest sources of funds that our state provides to folks throughout the state and to make sure that the Attorney General's office has the tools we need to make sure those funds are dispersed appropriately. Thank you, Chair Liebling.
All right. Thank you, Representative Norris. So we have a couple of testifiers. So welcome, whoever's going first. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, members of the committee. I'm Nick Wonka, the director of Minnesota's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, which is housed in the Attorney General's office. And I'm here today to testify in support of House File 2354, otherwise known as the MAP Act, which will help ensure that we in Minnesota continue to be able to investigate and prosecute fraudsters who steal taxpayer dollars that should be dedicated to providing critical health care services to Minnesota's most vulnerable people. Now, today I'm going to limit my testimony to three areas: the authority provision in Section 1, Subdivision 1, the legal representation in Section 2, and the venue Section 3, Subdivision 4. The authority provision, first, covers enhanced subpoena power for the Attorney General's Office's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. We are asking here for similar subpoena power that county attorneys have when they conduct criminal investigations. This revision would allow us to subpoena financial records in provider fraud investigations conducted under Minnesota Statute 256B12. County attorneys already have this authority when they conduct welfare fraud investigations, meaning that they're investigating people for defrauding publicly funded programs in the receipt of benefits. Granting the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit this authority when conducting provider fraud investigations is consistent with the judgment that investigating authorities and prosecutors should have the power to subpoena financial records when they're investigating people for defrauding public programs. Next, I'll address the legal representation in Minnesota Statute 256B12. This is largely unchanged. It does not grant the Attorney General's Office any more authority to prosecute crimes than it already has. Doesn't take anything away from county attorneys either. Right now, the statute permits the Attorney General's Office to prosecute violations of Minnesota Statute 609466, which is our current medical assistance fraud statute. Under the MAP Act, that statute would be recodified to Minnesota Statute 609467, and this revision would continue to allow us to prosecute medical assistance fraud. Finally, the venue provisions in Section 3, Subdivision 4. This provision is lifted from venue provisions elsewhere in law, most notably our theft statutes, our identity theft statutes, and our financial exploitation statutes. It's consistent with legislative judgments that that's how these cases should be venued, and we believe that in this case, there should be similar provisions when prosecuting medical assistance provider fraud. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I believe the other testifier is just here for questions. Okay. Very good. So is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. So with that, we'll close the testimony and we'll have some member discussion. Is there discussion, members? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in how specifically the Attorney General's Office plans to use the funds that are appropriated in this bill. Are we looking at bringing on new staff, new attorneys? Is there a plan for it?
Okay. And Mr. Wonka, go ahead and answer that. I would say I think that might be a little bit outside the jurisdiction of the committee, but go ahead.
Sure. So these funds would grant 9 additional positions to the Attorney General's Office's Medicaid Fraud Control Unit only. That would cover 7 investigators, 1 attorney, and 1 support staff. The reason that we're asking for that number is because it is a recommendation from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General. They determine the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit size based on the size of our state Medicaid budget, which has grown significantly in the past few years. Since we last asked for more people, the budgeted size was 32. Now, based on the size of our state Medicaid budget, it's 41. So all we're asking for is for people to come aboard consistent with that size.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you very much for that clarification. I appreciate the specificity.
All right. Thank you. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, just wondering if inactive investigative data in your unit will be public following when it becomes inactive?
The data, I would defer to the Data Practices Act and what it says about criminal investigative data.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. And so I'm wondering if Mr. Johnson might be able to weigh in on that question, given the recent Supreme Court decision on inactive investigative data. I'm just wondering, Mr. Johnson, if inactive investigative data in this fraud division will be publicly available. All right, Mr. Hopkins.
Mr. Hopkins,
sorry.
Madam Chair, Chair Scott, so the testifier noted that it would be classified as criminal investigative data under Section 13.82. And under that section, inactive investigative data is classified as public. Okay. Active investigative data is confidential.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Other discussion, members? Okay, so we are waiting on a member, I take it. Yeah. okay, well. Yeah, we're fine. Yeah, so, okay. So any closing comments, Representative Norris?
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. This is a bipartisan bill that will help us continue to make sure that we have program integrity in our Medicare and medical assistance divisions in the state, and appreciate your support for the legislation.
All right, so I will renew my motion that House File 2354, the second engrossment, be re-referred back to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is on its way. Thank you. All right, the next bill on our agenda is House File 1672, the first engrossment, Representative Ryer. Welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 1672 be re-referred back to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. And Representative Ryer, I don't see any amendments, so I think we're good to go. Please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair Scott, committee members. House File 1672 is an Office of Cannabis Management policy bill that makes a number of changes to make the program work better for medical cannabis patients and providers. It establishes access for visiting patients, providing reciprocity for non-Minnesota residents. It also incorporates reciprocity for tribal medical cannabis patients. This is the current status quo and is already allowed in Chapter 152 for the state's medical cannabis program. So this ensures that there's no disruption for tribal medical patients as we transition to the new statute. It includes other small changes to the medical cannabis program that prioritize patient protections so they can access the medical programs they need. As we transition the state from a medical cannabis program, medical cannabis program only, to an adult use and medical licensing framework, the goal is to consider continue refining the program to support patients. These revisions help continue to do this while also adding to the overall clarity of the bill. And Interim Director Tobel is here to go over these changes in detail.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead and tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Chair Scott. My name is Eric Tobel. I'm the Interim Director for the Minnesota Office of Cannabis Management. The pertinent provisions for the Judiciary Committee are in Section 9, which begins on line 6.6 of the bill. And it, as Representative Ryer notes, a lot of the action in this section is carrying forward existing opportunities for tribal medical patients in Chapter 152 into Chapter 342. 152 is where we currently regulate the medical cannabis program. 342 is where we will once we license cannabis businesses in the coming months. As noted, most of those changes relate to ensuring the same level of protection that exists for tribal medical patients in 152 and 342, but there are some additional protections that are added. I think notably those protections begin in Subdivision 3, which relates to rental property, and there's some protections laid out there that ensure that basically, being a member of the registry cannot itself be the basis for an adverse action in areas like housing, employment, or education. Additionally, the bill proposes additional changes or new changes to the sanctions for damages, including an increase in the maximum fine from $100 for a violation up to $1,000 for a violation, and importantly offers medical registry patients the opportunity to have injunctive relief. So that rather than this being sort of a post hoc relief where an action has occurred that has removed them from employment, from their house, or from their educational institution, they have the opportunity to stop that action if the action is being taken solely on the basis that the patient is a member of the Minnesota Medical Registry Program. Happy to answer any other questions about it, but that's the portions I think are most pertinent.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? All right, seeing none, we'll close the testimony and go to member discussion. Members, Representative, you want to go last? Or first? Okay. Chair Scott.
Go again. After. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have some questions on the school enrollment and rental property section. And if a person in those two environments has the certificate or the card or whatever is needed to be on medical cannabis, is there any sort of restriction on what form of medical cannabis they are on? Obviously, we don't want kids smoking pot at school. And I'm hearing concerns in multi-housing units where the next door neighbor is getting a strong smell of cannabis, and there's some hands that are tied because they have this medical card and they can't be discriminated against on the basis of that. So if you could address those issues.
Mr. Tauble.
Chair Leaving, Chair Scott, thank you for the question. As to the first question, the language is tied specifically to the participation in the program and does not relate to any sort of delivery method. So it doesn't speak to, there's no limitation on, you know, the protection only exists if you're using an ingestible or a smokable product, whatever it is. It's just the participation in the program, and specifically that the action can't be based on cannabis being a Schedule I narcotic, and so that. I think the second question is something the office has been dealing with quite extensively, which is there is a provision that prohibits in, I think it's multi-family dwellings, the use of cannabis products unless the person are vaping or smoking a cannabis product unless they're a member of the registry. The office has set up a complaint form to take in complaints from people who have a specific concern or issue about a neighbor violating this, and we're working with HOAs and management companies to have them, you know, sort of on the front lines looking into those sort of things. You're correct that there is that exemption in there for medical patients, though, specifically on the ability to use the smokable or vapable medical cannabis products in those multifamily housing.
Jessica?
Thank you. So I just want to repeat what I think I heard, but I'm not sure. So on the school premises, there's nothing prohibiting the smoking of the cannabis, and same with if you're in the program in an apartment building, you can smoke it.
Mr. Tauble.
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott. I want to clarify then my notes about the school position, which is that it doesn't speak to what is or is not allowed in terms of consumption of cannabis on a school property. I think the distinction would be a school could certainly take action if they found a student consuming cannabis against their policy, but they couldn't expel the student for being a medical cannabis patient. So I think the action of smoking cannabis inappropriately or illegally, if there's a policy design for the student, for instance, the school may say you can only have medical cannabis consumed through ingestible pills or the like. And if they violated the rule that was about how they consumed it, that would be distinct from taking negative action based on the fact that they were enrolled in the program only, rather than the behavior that violated the rule, if that makes sense.
Yeah, thank you. That clarifies that. So it's up to each individual school district to have their own rules around medical cannabis and how it can be consumed while on school grounds, is what you're saying.
Mr. Tauble.
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott. It harkens back to prior to this, I worked at the Department of Education in their general counsel's office, and as the medical cannabis program grew, we did get questions from schools about how they should handle these sort of things. And our go-to advice, and it's the advice I love as a lawyer, which is that you should definitely consult your general counsel. Consult your general counsel and your school leadership to make policies that comply both with Minnesota law and the protections afforded medical patients, but also that allow you to administer, you know, your school in an appropriate manner.
Yeah, thank you. Since this is a lawyer's committee, we love the lawyer answer here.
Well, that makes one of us that don't. Because that was like sort of an answer, but not concrete. And so walk me through again in a rental property. Mm-hmm. So I'm living next to someone that is a medical cannabis participant in that program, and they're smoking pot, and it's in my unit. I can't sleep. I have a respiratory issue. It's causing me problems. What is my course of action to protect my health and my happiness in my apartment?
So, and I would just say, Chair Scott, I think that's a really interesting question, but I think it's way beyond the bill. And the bill, I think, as I'm understanding it, is talking about discrimination against someone just for their status as a holder of a medical cannabis thing. I mean, it's an interesting question. I'm not going to stop the conversation on it. I just want to point out it's a different issue than the one, although, you know, I guess it's related. Certainly.
Okay. So thank you, Madam Chair. So could it be considered discrimination if you go to that person that's my neighbor and say, I know you're a medical cannabis user. You know, we're getting complaints from the neighbors. Could you get gummies? Could you get the oil? Could whatever? Is that landlord going to get in trouble and be charged with discrimination for something like that?
Mr. Tauble.
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott. So I think, and I worry if you were disappointed how lawyery my last answer was, this one may disappoint as well. But I think, again, in this particular case, there's two things that are at play, and both are sort of statutory protections. One is the general protection for anyone being discriminated against in housing for being a enrolled member of the registry program. And then there's a secondary prohibition in Minnesota law on the smoking or vaping of cannabis in multifamily dwelling homes, with the limited exception for medical patients. So when we get complaints about people consuming smoke or vapes in multifamily housing, we contact the HOA, we contact the management company, alert them that this complaint has been lodged at the office, and we provide them a number of steps they can take. We also contact the individual who's complained to provide them with the series of remedies they have available to them, which include there's some provisions around like nuisance, I think at the tail end of 342, that people may be able to use to sort of address those primary concerns. But I do think there is sort of a tension that there is a statutory exception for people to consume through smoke or vapor inhalation in a multifamily home.
Last question.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the levity here. So would it be better to put it in statute that if you're in a multifamily unit and you are a medical cannabis program participant, that you have to consume your medical cannabis in a form other than smoking it?
Mr.
I know that that may cause fewer lawyers to be employed.
Yeah.
But
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, for the good of the profession, then. I would actually note here that I do think that's a policy choice. I think whether or not the legislature deems the exception for smoking to be appropriate for a medical patient who has a rental unit or is in a condo, I would sort of defer to the wisdom of the legislature.
Very lawyer answer.
All right.
But I like it. You put it back in our plate. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was reading the letter provided in conjunction with this bill, and they talked about expanding it to healthcare facilities. And I just wanted to share a story from a constituent of mine who it's her ex-husband, but she helps care for him. He's in a long-term care facility and has dementia, and his doctor has prescribed him gummies. And these apparently are really helpful for his anxiety. He doesn't get up in the evening. He has had repeated incidents where he gets up and he's disoriented and scared and hurts himself. And so this, like, is really important to his health. And the facility they're in has said no. And in arguing over the statute around, like, long-term care facilities and their legal obligation to provide prescribed medication, the facility is pushing back. And in that context, the facility suddenly changed all of their funding so that they could no longer afford this facility, and so basically kicked them out for having this dispute. And it just seems really pointless. This is legally prescribed medication. And so I would just encourage you to consider expanding the scope of this. And maybe you could tell me if this would even help that scenario. But I I would have loved to have brought legislation, but I am really already like past my bandwidth, so I wasn't able to do it this year, but maybe you could incorporate something into this bill.
Mr. Topple, did you want to respond?
Chair Liebling, Representative Feist. Thank you. I think that the letter from the MNCAN organization highlights something that our customer service team hears a lot, which are similar to these stories about the ways in which sort of medical cannabis lays on top of existing frameworks can sometimes be challenging. I think that's in particular why the provisions that allow for injunctive relief can be so powerful, that you could at least stop, for instance, in that case, the removal from the facility while these issues are sorted out. So.
All right. Representative Feist, follow up. Okay. Other member discussion. All right. Seeing none, any closing comments, Representative Ryer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. No closing comments. I appreciate the time on the agenda today, the consideration, the questions and comments, and look forward to it going back to Commerce. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So I will renew the motion that House File 1672, the first engrossment, be re-referred back to the Commerce, Finance, Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Okay, the next thing on our agenda is House File 2389, the first engrossment. Representative Finke. And I think Representative Finke's motion is going to be that House File 2389 be re-referred back to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. Is that correct, Representative Finke?
That is correct. That's my motion.
Wonderful. And there is an author's amendment. All right, the A4. And do you want to, I think the A4 is it's kind of separate from the underlying bill. So maybe you would like to, am I correct? Maybe you'd like to discuss, present the underlying bill, and then we'll talk about the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so go ahead, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chairs and members. HF 2389 is a policy bill from the Commerce Department relating to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. And rather than do a lo-fi job of explaining the bill, I'm going to pass it over to the department to explain what we're doing.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, members of the committee, my name is Sam Smith, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2389 on behalf of the Department of Commerce. To the underlying bill, the sections that lie within the jurisdiction of this committee include the policy changes around data call. Sections 1 through 3 of the bill respond directly to industry feedback we received this fall while working with property and casualty insurers on a regulatory project. This proposal clarifies how data gathered from companies for a specific project or research purposes will be classified, providing more precision and clarity for companies and the department. This also clarifies how Commerce shares summary level information publicly while confirming that individual company data is appropriately shielded from public view. This proposal will help Commerce make our speed to market times faster when we conduct data calls that inform our regulatory practice and provides more specific clarity to insurers about the classification of their data so they can confidently partner with us in specific projects. This section one of the bill defines data call as a project where the Commerce is seeking information from companies for a specific and targeted regulatory purpose. We work with the industry on this definition so it is clear to all companies and the agency. Section two outlines the classification of company data under Chapter 13 and allows for summary level de-identified data to be shared publicly as a result of the data call project. It also includes language that matches what we have in several other sections of law regarding the sharing of data with regulatory or law enforcement partners. We use Minnesota Statutes 60A.031, subdivision 4E2 is our specific model here. Section 3 is a conforming change, adding data calls to the list of powers the commissioner has in this section. Thank you for your time. Happy to answer any questions to the underlying bill or transition to the amendment.
All right, thank you. So, with that, let me do this. Are there questions? Well, is there anyone else who wanted to testify to House File 2389, the underlying bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. So let's see if there are any questions on the underlying bill, and then we could go ahead and move the amendment and move to that. So are there questions on the underlying bill? Representative Steer.
Yes, Madam Chair. So the stat part of this that covers the auto insurance, does that fall under this purview, or is that somewhere else?
Let's see. What section are you looking at?
Well, that's the thing, is I was looking through this trying to figure out where this affects the auto insurance. And okay. It references a lot, but I can't find anywhere in the bill where.
Okay. Well, let's just ask the testifier the question. Go ahead.
Chair Liebling, Representative Steer, thank you for the question. The policy changes around APSO, or Minnesota's auto insurance plan, lie within the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee, where it's already been reviewed.
Okay. Representative Steer? Okay. Very good. Okay. All right. So seeing no further discussion on that piece, Representative Finke, do you want to go ahead and move the A4 amendment?
Yes, I move the A4 amendment for adoption, and we'll pass it over to my testifier to explain the amendment.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Smith, go ahead.
Chair Scott, Chair Liebling again, my name is Sam with the department. The A4 amendment contains language that has already been heard and vetted by the House Commerce Committee, where it has bipartisan support. Due to challenges jacketing this language, we've had to move it via an amendment to ensure that it goes through the Judiciary Committee. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners, or NAIC, created this model legislation, where it has already been scrutinized by state regulatory bodies and our industry partners, to ensure that the insurance industry is consistently regulated in each state. This is legislation that must pass for the Department of Commerce to maintain our accreditation from the NAIC. The group capital and liquidity changes to Chapter 60D provide an additional analytical tool for the Minnesota Department of Commerce to understand the financial condition of non-insurance entities with an insurance holding system. The data classification provisions are consistent with existing data classification of similar data reported to the Minnesota Department of Commerce pursuant to 60D. Minnesota Statute 60D.22 provides that similarly reported data are classified as confidential or protected, non-public, or both. All of which is to say that there are not substantive changes to how this data is classified. We're just allowing it for an additional regulatory purposes under our group capital and liquidity solvency checks.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Smith. So, are there questions? Well, let me first ask, is there anyone else who in the room who wants to testify on the amendment, on the A4 amendment? All right, seeing none, is there member discussion to the A4 amendment? All right, not seeing any. So let's vote then on adoption of the A4. So all in favor of adoption of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to the bill as amended, is there any discussion? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm, in all honesty, I'm reading our committee brief here from our folks, and it says that perhaps the data call, there's questions around how the data call information might be used by the Department of Commerce for task forces and other entities doing studies, and that it's a pretty broad sweep of what the department can do with the data. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more and protections other than the anonymization of it or the de-identity of it?
Mr. Smith?
Thank you.
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, thank you for the question. To be clear, this does not expand the authority of the Department of Commerce to seek new information, but it is to allow us to classify information in a different way for a specific regulatory purpose of the Department of Commerce. And so that authority and power is not necessarily going to be available to the legislature, or would not be available to the legislature for something like a task force.
Chair Scott?
Okay. I guess I'll let it go at that, I guess.
Okay. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering how much conversation has been had with the insurance companies and insurance groups that engage in legislative outreach. How much have they had input on how this is going to function?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Liebling, Representative Hudson, thank you for the question. We have worked closely with our industry partners, and in the Commerce Committee, we adopted an amendment specifically based upon feedback we got from our insurance industry partners to ensure that there are appropriate guardrails around the use of this data call authority.
Okay.
Thank you for that answer.
All right. Representative Steer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So where is the oversight on this? Is it you just do whatever you want and nobody's looking at it, or what commission is looking at this to make sure you're staying in compliance?
Mr. Smith.
Chair Liebling, Representative Steer, thank you for the question. This data call power has to be used for a specific regulatory purpose that can help us make more informed decisions about managing the insurance market. For example, when the Department of Commerce and the insurance industry worked together around data call work following a tornado in North Minneapolis in 2011. So the limiting factor is that it can't be seeking broad general information, but towards a very specific and targeted regulatory question.
Representative Steer? Okay. Chair Scott.
Yeah. So I like your line of questioning there, but how will we know if you're not stepping out of those bounds?
Mr. Smith?
Chair Liebling, Chair Scott, thank you for the question. Yeah, I do want to reiterate that Commerce currently has the authority to request this information, and the primary change is around how we are able to classify it and then make it public for our policy purposes. There's no new data that we're going to be able to gather under this legislation.
So I guess, Madam Chair, it would have been a question for the underlying language, which I guess is not before us, but.
Chair Scott, that's next year's bill. All right, any other discussion? All right, seeing none, so Representative Finke is going to renew the motion that House File 2389, the first engrossment as amended, be re-referred back to the Department of Commerce. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
It's a complicated
I'm sorry, did I say the Department of Commerce? Yeah. Commerce Committee. Clearly it's not going to the Department of Commerce.
it's a deeply confusing piece of legislation.
Yeah. Okay. All right, the next bill on our agenda is House File 2870, Representative Freiberg. And I will move that House File 2870 be re-referred to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. And there is an A1 amendment. And welcome, Representative Freiberg. Did you want to move the A1 amendment right away?
If you could, that would be.
Or do you want to? Why don't you go ahead and just tell us what the bill is, and then we'll move the amendment if that.
Sure. Bill contains provisions. The bill overall contains the provisions from the Secretary of State's administrative bill that we thought might be relevant to the Judiciary Committee. We just wanted to make sure those provisions got heard here. From committee staff, I understand that the only provision the committee is interested in is Section 5, which is lines 4.23 to 6.8, so I will constrain my remarks to that section. So in the last election, there were a couple examples of errors that occurred on ballots. They weren't malicious errors, but we do want to make sure there's a process in place for correcting errors on ballots. I know there's a member of this committee who may have had the wrong middle initial placed on the ballot, but that was able to work out a situation there. So the bill prescribes an out-of-court remedy to resolve an error, omission, or wrongful act that occurs, and this should help correct ballot errors more expeditiously. The process outlined requires the candidates involved in the local jurisdiction charged with the error, omissions, or wrongful act to unanimously agree in writing that an error occurred and agree upon an appropriate correction. It also allows an official to correct any official ballot if a formatting issue occurs. The amendment before you addresses some concerns raised by the GOP in the Elections Committee when we heard the admin bill overall. It adds clarification of what an agreement to correct an error must include to ensure that the agreement is comprehensive. The final change makes crystal clear that using this out-of-court remedy is not exclusive, and any person can still file a motion for a petition to correct errors and omissions in court. So I don't know if you want to consider the amendment now or have my testifier.
I think so. Given that, Representative Freiberg, I think it would be wise to just to adopt the amendment. So I would move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape, and then we can discuss the whole bill. So any questions for members on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So with that, Representative Freiberg, did you want to say more about the bill as amended, or should we go to your testifier?
No, with me to testify is Nicole Freeman from the Office of the Secretary of State.
Right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Nicole Freeman from the Office of the Secretary of State. Thank you so much today for hearing House File 2870. As Representative Freiberg mentioned, these are a few portions of our admin bill that we thought might be considered by this committee. But I will, like he said, I'll limit my testimony to Section 5. Representative Freiberg did a really good job of giving an overview of what this section of the bill seeks to do. And I think I'll just talk a little bit more about the experience that sort of led us to want to create this out-of-court remedy. So right now, when an error or omission, or I guess I should back up, when our election administrators are creating the ballot, there's often many, many ballot styles within a county. And, you know, several offices, ballot questions, and things like that. So they do a number of rounds and oftentimes will work with a ballot vendor or may program their ballots within the in-house. They do a number of rounds of edits and try to catch any errors. Occasionally, errors do happen, though. As Representative Freiberg mentioned, one error that occurred last year. Another situation happened in southern Minnesota that you might have heard about from your colleague, Representative Bennett. She filed for office and said she affiliated with the Republican Party. Her opponent filed for office and said they affiliated with the DFL party. When things were printed, those party affiliations inadvertently got switched. So that in that that ballot error was realized after printing, unfortunately. But the solution to it, right, is a really easy one. Those affiliations need to be switched, and the ballots need to be reprinted. Instead of an election administrator and the candidates being able to have that agreement and move forward with ballot printing, the county attorney of that county needed to go to court, file an errors and omissions petition, wait for those court proceedings to happen. And then, I can't remember the number of days, but days and days later, then finally that error could be corrected, ballots reprinted, and then, reprinted ballots getting out to absentee voters or people wanting to vote in person. So our remedy would prescribe a method for election administrators to work with any candidates involved and allow them to come to an agreement of how to correct that error. The amendment... That first part of the amendment really details what has to be included in the agreement. So there's nothing left. There's no gray area left out there. And then the final part, again, makes it really clear that if someone does want to go to court, they certainly can. One provision that's also in here is a little bit of a incentive on page 6. We did want there to be some incentive for candidates to agree at the top of page 6 on 6.1. We wanted there to be incentive for candidates to agree so that we could have timely resolution. And what it says is that if a candidate doesn't enter into an agreement and they don't prevail in court and the judge finds that their position was not substantially justified, they could be liable for court costs, just court costs, which is a smaller, not talking full attorney's fees. It's in very limited situations, but I think we're hoping that that can help incentivize folks to come to the table and come to an amicable agreement. Again, oftentimes these situations are very obvious. In one situation, it was a a candidate's middle name was put incorrectly on the ballot. In another situation, it was the parties were switched. In a third situation I can think of from 2024, the wrong candidates appeared on a ballot. The A side was on the B side ballots. And so again, a mistake, something that really needs to be corrected, but something that usually has a pretty clear solution. For the situations that don't have a clear solution, I think all folks involved would want to go to court, right? There are situations where this remedy, isn't a good fit, and court would still be necessary. But we're hoping that this can save election administrators, county attorneys, as well as district court judges a lot of time and get ballots out to voters quicker. So happy to take any questions and talk more about whatever areas you'd like to. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. So is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? All right. Not seeing anyone. So member discussion. Okay. Representative Frazier.
Just a comment because I experienced this. Rep. Freiberg, thank you for bringing the bill. Thank you for testifying from the Secretary of State's office. And I think it's good that we're going to offer an efficient out-of-court process for this. I had no idea when I reported to the Secretary of State, you all were very quick and thorough and responded and helped me walk through what needed to happen to get it rectified. But it was a process that I didn't expect that would be that involved. So thank you. I appreciate this.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was just thinking about the situation where the parties were switched. So if I was Representative Bennett's opponent and I just decided, well, I just as soon keep it the way it is and opposed making the change, the obvious change, and then went to court under this bill, I would be really disincentivized from being, if I just wanted to be a jerk, for example, I would be disincentivized from doing that. I think that's a very good practice. So, all right, other discussion? Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg. I only have one question here, because I think that this bill is pretty good overall. But repealing Section 209.06, would that also not allow for judges to potentially inspect those ballots as they have been awarded and allowed to in the past?
Ms. Freeman?
Thank you, Chair and Representative Engen. So the intention in repealing 209.06 is that this section was put in back in the 50s, I believe, maybe even earlier than that. But it really was before we had a recount process. And so right now, ahead of an election contest, generally, there is an inspection. Generally, there is a recount that's called first, right? There's a recount first, then those results are canvassed, and then a contest is filed. To answer your question directly, no, we don't believe that this would mean that a court couldn't authorize the examination of ballots. But this process really is sort of the precursor to our recount process. And so because of that, it's just not often that a judge is prescribing people to recount the ballots again, because typically that is happening through the full recount process that's laid out in statute.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. So a court-ordered ballot inspection could still take place despite the repealer in 209.06.
Ms. Freeman.
Thank you, Representative Liebling, Chair and Representative Engen. Yes, that's how we would read things. There's still other places in statute that state, for example, that ballot envelopes need to stay sealed. The envelopes or containers containing the voted ballots need to stay sealed, except for by court order or authorized by the Secretary of State is in one statute. And so I think there's other places throughout statute that allow, that still give an allowance for the court to do that.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion? All right. Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 2870 as introduced, but no, as amended, be re-referred to the Elections, Finance, and Government Operations Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, House File 2743, Representative Jordan, welcome to the committee. And let's see, the motion here is that House File 2743 be re-referred to the Education Policy Committee. And I don't think there's an amendment, so I think Representative Jordan, welcome, and please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is an MDE, Minnesota Department of Education policy bill, specifically as it relates to the Office of the Inspector General. We are carrying this as part of our education policy comprehensive bill, and so this is just the parts of the bill that pertain to this committee. So with me, I do have folks from the Minnesota Department of Education to walk through the bill and explain why these changes are necessary. Thank you.
All right. Very good. So who wants to go first? Welcome, Mr. Uni. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Adosh Uni. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Department of Education. With me today, I have Martin Halden, MDE's General Counsel. Thank you for hearing the provisions today, which are contained in the governor's education policy bill. Additionally, the Office of Inspector General provisions are also in the governor's anti-fraud package, which I believe the committee has heard as well. The Office of Inspector General, that is heard in another committee, but just note it's in multiple places. The Office of Inspector General is charged with protecting the integrity of MDE and the state by detecting and preventing fraud, waste, and abuse in MDE's programs. The OIG accomplishes this by conducting independent and objective investigations to promote the integrity of the department's programs and operations. When the OIG detects fraud or other misuse of public funds, the Inspector General works with law enforcement to partner on any investigations and in support of any subsequent civil and criminal prosecution. The office may also recommend a range of sanctions to the commissioner, including temporary and permanent sanctions like withholding payments, ending program participation, and recovering funds. Since the establishment of the MDE's OIG in statute, the first state OIG established in statute, and with funding from the 2023 legislative session, we've been busy setting up the office, initiating investigations, and implementing improvements. Last session, the legislature passed additional language to add to MDE's OIG statute around critical investigatory powers, definitions, sanction authorities, and reporter protections. This year, as our OIG continues to do its work, we have found that in further enhancements, definitions, protections, and clarifications are needed for the office to fully achieve its goal of fraud prevention and program integrity. I'm going to summarize some of these pieces with a focus on those identified for the committee's jurisdiction. These proposals bolster relationships with law enforcement by more clearly maintaining the confidentiality of investigatory data and by applying the comprehensive law enforcement data statute to MDE's OIG. Next, the proposals enhance the effectiveness and efficiency of investigations by establishing clear expectations around OIG access to program participant records. We also seek greater clarification around sanctions MDE can take if the OIG has credible indicia of fraud or there is a finding of fraud. Last year's changes allowed the commissioner to impose temporary sanctions on program participants who were removed from another state or federal program for fraud, waste, or abuse based on OIG's recommendation. This proposal allows MDE to take a range of actions against program participants that have been excluded from public funds administered by MDE or other Minnesota state agency or a federal agency. And this is such as prohibiting the excluded program participant from receiving grant funds or disenrolling or debarring from other MDE programs. It would also allow MDE to suspend payments to providers when there is a credible allegation of fraud for which an investigation is pending for a program administered by a Minnesota state agency or a federal agency. Fraud prevention relies on those that report program concerns. That is why adding further clarification on protections for employees and non-employee individuals who make good faith reports on suspected fraud, waste, and abuse. The proposal clarifies appropriate application of law to employees and extends civil liability immunity to employees and non-employees. The last proposal being considered here on the OIG simply gives the office authority to obtain data from Deeds Unemployment Insurance Office when required. Finally, I'll just note the one non-OIG proposal in the bill, which is Section 1. We're just seeking technical clarification by referring to federal law that parental consent is still required for schools to share parent and student information with DEED on students with disabilities for the purposes of coordinating vocational rehabilitation services and supports. The requirement is already in federal and state law, and adding it here would eliminate any confusion. So again, thank you for the opportunity to present these critical enhancements to our OIG statute as we seek to uphold the mission of program integrity and fraud prevention. And Ms. Holden and I can answer any questions from the committee.
All right. Thank you very much. And Ms. Holden, you didn't have separate testimony. Okay. Very good. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? I don't see anyone. So we'll close testimony and we will go to member discussion. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a specific question, and forgive me, this is like a huge bill that I'm really only looking at in a great amount of detail right now, so this may be a dumb question. Line 5.6, so the definition of abuse includes obtaining or attempting to obtain department program funds when required information is missing or incorrect. And I just know that I'm not perfect, and sometimes I have typos, and is that abuse if somebody makes a typo, or is that in a larger context where it's already, that they're already doing something that is questionable? Because that just seems like a very expansive definition of abuse.
Ms. Holden, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. My name is Maren Holden. I'm General Counsel at MDE. Thank you for the question, Representative Feist. So the abuse definitions that are added here are all examples, and our thinking behind them is that oftentimes we have program participants, we may have program participants that where the fraud is not immediately evident, but this kind of example gives our OIG the jurisdiction to investigate, and oftentimes the beginning of fraud might look like repeated mistakes or just an inability to manage. You can't often tell at the outset whether inability to kind of manage the administrative like requirements of a program is, people not really understanding how it works, not having like the best internal controls or their own practices, or if it's something more malicious or intentional. And so what this does is it allows our OIG to investigate situations where that's occurring. Whether or not sanctions would be imposed is a separate question that would, I think, depend on what is found.
Representative Feist.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That's reassuring. So is there somewhere else in the statute that talks about like a totality of circumstances or what the standard is for sanctions?
Ms. Holden.
Yeah, Chair Liebling, Representative Feist. So this gets into a little bit of some of the changes that Mr. Uni was outlining. Currently, in our current statute, most of the sanctions authorities live in what's Section 9 in this bill, Subdivision 5 of the current statute. And what we're doing is kind of articulating multiple different types of sanctions through the subsequent sections, 13, 14, 15, and 16. But what remains in Section 9 is an overall authority for the OIG to recommend sanctions to the commissioner based on an ultimate finding at the conclusion of an investigation of by a preponderance of the evidence, fraud, theft, waste, or abuse. So it does technically permit sanctions based on abuse. But what I can say is that we don't have infinite bandwidth. We are going to we focus on kind of the biggest problems, and I think really the way that as we've designed this language, the enhancements and the clarifications of the abuse definitions are focused on really being able to initiate investigations to find serious fraud.
Representative Feist.
Yep, thank you for that answer, and I trust you, and I trust that this definition would be used appropriately. But I'm thinking a lot these days about what we put in law that might just hang out there into the future. And, some future
administration might look at that definition and think about how it can be used in a way that is not the intention here. So just something to think about. Maybe we want to do something about that line to make sure that a future administration isn't able to say we're withholding funding because you made a typo. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Feist. And just before I go to the next member, thank you for flagging that. I think you're right. And to flag it, as I'm reading the more of the section, though, it talks about behavior that is deficient or improper when compared with behavior that a prudent person would consider a reasonable and necessary business practice given the facts and circumstances. And then abuse includes, but is not limited to, and then that section is one of the pieces. So I hear you on that. I don't know, maybe there is some room for tightening that up a little bit, but it gives me comfort that it's kind of in the context of what's there. Yeah. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one question for you guys. So if a 501c3 or a 501c4 is applying for grants through the department and they don't have an up-to-date 990 form through the IRS, would that immediately make them ineligible to receive funding?
Ms. Halden?
Chair Liebling, Representative Engen, that's a great question. You know, it might depend on the requirements of the program and whether it's a grant or whether it's a legislative appropriation. Certainly, we routinely check for 990 status if the entity puts itself out there as a C3. I don't honestly know off the top of my head whether or not, like, for example, we give grants out to school districts. Those are not C3s. And so there are different types of entities that receive our funds. And it really kind of depends on what the funding stream is, what the grant program is, and what the requirements are. If an entity is a C3, then an up-to-date 990, you know, is absolutely something that we will insist on. And depending on this, you know, the size of the budget, sometimes a federal single audit is required too, and we have routine ways of checking for those.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the response. I'd love to see that in the language. I think that would ensure proper oversight and accountability, and just making sure that they're even doing the due diligence of crossing the bare minimum T's and dotting the I's before receiving any funding. Thank you.
Representative Steer.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. So under 9.14, it says no state employee may interfere or obstruct with the investigation authorized by this section. Is that a criminal code then? Is it a criminal violation, or what is the penalty if they obstruct this? And it should it be noted in here that it would be a violation of, like, obstructing a legal process?
Ms. Halden?
Chair Liebling, Representative Stewart, that's a great question. You know, this language does not delineate penalties. I think it would be up to, like, local law enforcement authorities whether or not that gives, like, amounts to any criminal penalties and meets the thresholds for that. You know, this doesn't change the fact that Section 181.932 already protects employees from retaliation or interference. And so we think that our new subdivision 8 kind of gives broader immunity and protection against retaliation to reporters, but that 181.932 as is a strong protection for employees, which is why we've proposed the change as it's outlined here.
Representative Steer. Okay.
Representative Scott, did you want to?
Okay. All right. Any other discussion? All right. Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 2743 be re-referred to the Education Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any awake? Okay. The motion prevails. Thank you. Okay. Yes, we certainly could do that. Hanson. Oh, well, then let's go to Hanson because I think we should. So next we will go to House File 1918. Representative Hanson. Mm-hmm.
And welcome to the committee, Representative Hansen. I will move that House File 1918 be re-referred to the Children, Families, Finance, and Policy Committee. So there is no amendment. So Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'm going to stick to Articles 2 and 3 because it's my understanding that that's what's within your jurisdiction to cover today. And so Article 2 is a Great Start Compensation Support Payment payment Program Policy Update. That is a tongue twister, but this just clarifies which data that's collected in this program is considered public and what's considered non-public. Article 3 is a child welfare section, and this is really a housekeeping, technical, and policy updates. So you're going to find this in sections 1 to 5, 7 to 9, 11 to 12, 16, 19 to 22, 24 to 27, and 29 to 30. And so what this does is it clarifies the policy requirements in the Minnesota African American Family Preservation and Child Welfare Disproportionality Act to support its implementation. It adds clarifying language that clearly states the inquiry of American Indian heritage is required for all children and families in any kind of child welfare matter. It replaces some of the old language with official terminology as well. It also corrects a statutory cross-reference in this section. It aligns the statute with DCYF guidance related to the reestablishment of parental rights to allow for a child who is not currently adopted to be reunified with a biological parent through reestablishment of parental rights if a prior adoption was dissolved, and to allow parents whose consent to adoption was accepted by the courts, and it's to allow them to be eligible for reestablishment if the identified prospective adoptive parent did not finalize the adoption or if the adoption is dissolved. It also aligns the statute with DCYF guidance to clarify the timeline, information gathering authority, and documentation requirements for the agencies conducting non-caregiver human trafficking assessments as well. In Section 6 and 28, you'll find parts about supporting and preserving families to prevent foster care placement. And this proposal allows counties and tribes to provide a prevention response to educational neglect reports prior to a child protection response. The current statute right now requires that a child protection response be opened at 7 unexcused absences in school. Unexcused absences can be related to poverty and or other support needs that the family has, and these are often confused with neglect. And so this would allow the counties and tribes to respond in a preventative and holistic way and provide resources and support without requiring that immediate maltreatment response. These prevention efforts will improve engagement and attendance while decreasing unnecessary entry into the child protection system, with a decrease, hopefully, in disparities in the child protection system as well. A child protection response, if the unexcused absences continue, is still allowed under this change, so that will not change. Prevention for unexcused absences is supported by the Institute to Transform Child Protection and MACSA, as was proposed in the 2024 legislative session. The next sections in 10, 13 to 15, 17 to 18, and 23 to 24 has two provisions under the foster care policy modifications. Currently, Minnesota statutes require out-of-home placement plans to be prepared within 30 days after a child is placed in foster care. And this proposal aligns the statute with federal statute by requiring that the out-of-home placement plan is completed within 60 days while maintaining the policy goals of our last legislature by requiring these be the out-of-home placement plan summaries within 30 days. For youth in foster care at 17 and a half, existing policy requires that the responsible agency is to provide a notice to the youth, parents, and others about the extended foster care program. And this proposal adds a court report to review at 90 days prior to turning 18 to inform the court of the youth's intentions to ensure that all of their needs and services have been addressed. That is the summary of Articles 2 and 3. And if you'd like to talk about any of the other sections or articles here, I'm happy to do that as well, Chair. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hansen. And do you have a testifier or just are you just
the department is here, Chair, if you have any questions that I need to call in, phone a friend.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you for that. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on the bill? Okay. Not seeing anyone. So we will go to member discussion. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the department for this really helpful table that I think I know who is responsible for this, someone that I've worked with in the past, but it's really helpful.
Yes.
I mean, because there's a lot of material here for us to cover, and this really parses it down. So I want to thank them for, like, helping us digest everything that's in the bill. Thank you.
Okay. Any other discussion? All right, not seeing any. So a lot of material here, I agree. And yeah, thank you very much and appreciate the presentation. And so with that, if there is no further discussion, I will renew the motion that House File 1918 be re-referred back to Children and Families Finance and Policy. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you. Next, we will go to House File 2551, the first engrossment. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon, and thanks for your patience. I know you've been here a while waiting to have your bill heard. And so I will move that House File 2551 be placed on the general register. And you have an author's amendment, I believe. And it looks like it's mostly technical. So do you want to move that now, and then we'll discuss the bill as amended?
Yes, it is a technical amendment from the department after additional discussions.
Okay. So then I will move the A25-0043 amendment. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A25-0043 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chairs, and grateful to be here in Judiciary today. Appreciate everyone's time. As you all know, even though we weren't all here in 2023 when we passed the funding to create the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. Many of the agency groups and functions are moving from the Department of Human Services, Department of Public Safety, as well as the Department of Education over to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families. And at the end of last session, we did have another recodification bill and worked with the revisor's office such that they could make any additional changes that they felt were needed in order to comply with the legislative directive in that bill. However, in further discussions with the revisor's office this year, they feel that there are a few changes that they were not able to make as they're technically policy changes, things along the lines of adding the new commissioner of DCYF to groups or boards that DHS commissioner or the Department of Education commissioner already sit on. So technically, the revisor's office didn't feel that that's within their capacity to make those changes. We anticipate that this will be the final recodification bill when it comes to implementing the transition to the new department, and the department is here if anyone has any specific questions.
All right, thank you very much. So is there anyone who wants to testify on the bill? Not seeing anyone. Member discussion. Chair Scott.
I'll just say again, thank you for the very helpful table. If you notice, the second column even notes the section of the statute that's being changed, and so I just thankful for that. It's another big bill, and so it's helpful to have some guidance there. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. And I just would say thank you to the revisor's office. I know it was kind of unusual to have someone from the revisor's office come to my office and tell me that this was their work, and, you know, I think that's really helpful. So I know they do a lot for us, and this is good to get this taken care of. Recodifications are really helpful. It just helps us all move forward with our work and understand better what we're doing in the statutes. So Thank you. Any final words from you, Representative Katisa-Watoon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, all I would say is that the recodification bill that we passed last session, I believe passed unanimously off the House floor. Chair West and I had a discussion together with the revisor's office as well, and I anticipate not having any problems in discussions going forward to pass this.
Great. Okay, thank you. So I will renew the motion that House File 2551, the first engrossment as amended, be re-referred to the, be placed on the general register. Good, last stop. Okay, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. All right, Chair Pinto is here, wonderful. So Chair Pinto is next. And last but not least, House File 1671, the first engrossment. So I will move that House File 1671, the first engrossment, be re-referred back to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. And Chair Pinto, welcome. And please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and congrats, members, on making it through a hearing like relatively speedily, which is great. So House File 1671 is the technical policy bill from the Department of Labor and Industry, and I believe that there's just a very small provision that's within the jurisdiction of this committee. I may be wrong, but I believe that it's lines 1.6 to 1.12, we've got Mr. Moore from DLI who can presumably describe that, but just a collection of minor changes that have been brought to us by the department.
All right. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name, please, and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Josiah Moore. I'm the Legislative Director at the Department of Labor and Industry. Thanks for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 1671, which is the department's policy and technical bill. Within this committee's jurisdiction, I would like to specifically highlight my support for Section 1, as Chair Pinto noted, which establishes authority for DLI to apply in district court for an order restraining an employer from violations of employment laws under DLI's jurisdiction. If issued by the district court, this temporary restraining order would require an employer to come into compliance with the law in question. The reason we are seeking this is because some violations, including things like violations of the Women's Economic Security Act and anti-retaliation statutes, are so time-sensitive that irreparable damage may be done to the employee by the time a compliance order is issued and a case proceeds to the administrative contested case process. So, for example, if a pregnant worker was being denied accommodations under the pregnancy accommodation law, by the time the contested case process were complete, the pregnant worker would have given birth, and the window to guarantee rights to pregnancy accommodations in the workplace would have been missed. So a court order restraining the violation would allow the department to intervene more quickly and help ensure that something like pregnancy accommodations are provided in a timely manner to an employee. And that wraps my testimony in support, and I'll remain for any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? There aren't too many people left in the room here. Seeing none, we'll close testimony and go to member discussion. So is there any member discussion? Today we've gone from big complicated stuff to now teeny tiny little provision. So, all right, seeing no discussion, Representative Pinto, any final words?
No, thank you, Chair Liebling. Thank you, Chair Scott, and thanks, members. Appreciate it.
All right, so I will renew the motion that House File 1671, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the Workforce, Labor, and Economic Development, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
And the bill is on its way back to your committee. Chair Pinto, thank you very much. And members, thank you for coming in for the extra hearing. We are adjourned.